Today, we're going to review the book entitled The End of Anger, A New Generation's Take on Race and Rage. The book is written by best-selling author Ellis Coase. Ellis, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Stan. It's good to be with you.
On the cover of the book, you state that there is a diminishment of black anger. You also said that there was a general shift in the American mindset. What do you mean by a diminishing black anger?
Well, this is not my finding, actually. I mean, there have been a series of polls that have been taken by Gallup, by Harris, by the Washington Post, by Harvard, which have effectively shown that when asked a number of questions, which gauge optimism and feelings about the future, et cetera, blacks are not only more optimistic than these measures have shown them to be and since they have been taken in the last few decades, but also more optimistic than whites. Yeah, and so it's, and clearly part of this is connected to the Obama presidency, to the ascension of Barack Obama to the White House. But there is this idea that has taken hold, and part of it is also generational. We can talk about that as well. But I think that there's this idea that's taking hold that the sense that there was an unbreachable a glass ceiling, that there were positions and goals to which blacks just could not aspire, is weakening. And I think that as a result of that beginning to weaken, there is a diminishment of the sort of old form black rage.
Well, why is there this diminishment? You said that we are, you know, when I say we, I'm talking about black folk. You're mm-hmm. saying that black folk are more optimistic, even though at this point in time, we are suffering from the greatest unemployment we've ever had. We're suffering from...
I think the only way to understand it, Stanley, is to talk about the short term and the long term. That's absolutely right. Black unemployment is roughly twice as high as white unemployment at this point. The devastation that blacks have experienced since the downturn in the economy, everything from foreclosures on homes to the loss of whatever accumulated wealth that existed, has hit blacks much more severely than it has hit whites. And I think that most blacks are certainly well aware of this. But I think when you talk about the sense of optimism that's there, it's not the sense that we are doing great right now in this economy. It's a sense that something fundamental has changed about the American opportunity structure.
And that fundamental thing is the Messiah, Barack Obama?
Not the Messiah. I mean, I think he's as much of a symbol as anything else. I think it's all tied into, and your term is him, for him is Messiah. I certainly don't consider him a Messiah, but if you do, that's interesting.
But it's not that I consider him a Messiah. You use the word Messiah in the book several times.
I never say Barack Obama is a Messiah. What I've said is that there are certain people who attribute those kinds of attributes to him. But quote me a point where I argue that he is a Messiah, and you can't find it because I don't say that. You know, but my larger point is that particularly, and let me just back up for a second. A large part of this book is based on surveys that were done, two surveys in particular. You know, one of Harvard MBAs who were black, and the other of graduates of A Better Chance, which is a program that sends kids to selective high schools throughout the country and then follows them, you know, to some extent throughout their career. And what I've picked up and what other pollsters picked up in other ways as well, you know, is that when you ask this younger cohort about what their opportunities are likely to be in the world, they have a very different set of responses than the older cohort, than people who are over 40 and certainly people who are over 65. You know, and I think it's easy to say, oh, well, Ellis is saying everything is fine with black folks, and many people have chosen to misread the book and to put that interpretation on it. That's a misreading of the book. It's a fundamental misreading of the book. I'm not saying that.
There's a quote in the book by a fellow named Marable.
Manny Marable.
Marable, yes.
Yeah.
He said that Obama's election was the final revelation, the long-awaited sign that a new American age has dawned. Then he goes on to say that it blows away the nationalists' argument that the system is white and racist and won't ever change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is he or are you making the argument that because Barack Obama has become the president, then black nationalist voices should be silenced on that issue?
I don't know why you want to put these words in my mouth. I never said anybody should be silenced. There's a First Amendment in this country that allows people to
say. Well, maybe I shouldn't use the word. You know, okay, I shouldn't use the word silence, but the point of that statement is that.
No. What he is saying is that there has been a set of assumptions, certainly exhibited by black nationalists, but by others as well, that blacks will never be allowed to achieve anything in this country. And there have been a set of assumptions that race and purely race will keep that from happening, and that is changing. Yeah. I mean, I think that if you talk to most folks in this country, they will concede that the America of today is not the America of the 1950s.
It seems that the younger generation, which you refer to as Generation 3, and then, of course, your daughter, I think you said your daughter, would be considered Generation 4. You espouse the notion that when those folk become of age, then race will be much less important.
Well, I think race is already less important. I mean, that doesn't mean that we don't have a huge legacy of race. And if you read the book carefully, you know, you will see that it makes an argument that we are still dealing hugely with the legacy of racism and race in this country, and that there are still racists in this country. I don't expect, my daughter is 9 years old, I don't expect her to come up in a country without racists or without racism.
So why do you say the end of anger? Why is anger, are black people no longer angry in this country?
Stanley, have you ever read a book that sums up everything it's saying in the title? You write a book because you're writing a book, not because people just read the title. The title is a telegraphing of a much larger idea. And the reason it's named The End of Anger is you're trying to come up with, in three or four words, what describes part of a concept that is central to the book. No, am I saying that all black folks are not angry? Of course not. Don't be silly. Of course I'm not saying that.
There is this idea that was that you discussed in the book that Barack Obama's victory has made America an unhappier and more volatile place. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I think so that the rise of the Tea Party has a lot to do with anger among whites, particularly among older whites, that America is changing in a way they find very threatening. The sort of racially tinged rhetoric that has been directed at Obama, I think, has a lot to do with this collection of white fears. And you have a generation, at least members of a generation of white folks, who look up and say, my God, we have all these brown folks coming on over into the United States from across the border. We have, all these, we have these black folks down in the White House and in the in the Justice Department and elsewhere, and increasingly becoming visible. And for them, I think this is a frightening turn of events. And I think you see a lot of this anger, this whole idea of taking America back, which is sort of the unofficial model of the Tea Party, is about taking it back from whom? Well, from whom they perceive it has taken it over now.
Yeah, and it seems that the Tea Party is angry. In other words, I'm assuming that the Tea Party is majority white or other than black.
Well, it's clearly majority white. You know, every sort of analysis of their membership has them, well over 90% white, so they're like 98-99% white group, sure.
Right, so it's a reversal of roles. It's almost as if the Tea Party, meaning the white folk involved in the Tea Party, are more angry and black folk are less angry. Is that your read of it?
I think that's true. I think what they are seeing is that the world they knew is changing, and they don't know what the consequences of this will be, but they don't like it. And they want, against all logic and against all common sense, to try to take us back to some world that they're comfortable in.
There's another quote you use regarding Ben Jealous. That's the president of the NAACP.
Right.
And he said that he was talking about the Tea Party. He says that when David Duke sees the Tea Party go by, He assumes that that is his parade. In other words, he very much equates the Tea Party with the, of course, we know who David Duke is. So he's equating the Tea Party with the Klan mentality.
Well, the former head of the KKK, sure. Yeah, I mean, he clearly sees it as an angry white movement, which is clearly what the KKK was.
So the Tea Party is certainly in your mind, at least a racist movement. Is that?
Well, I mean, what I think it does is that it has racist elements in it, and it draws a lot of energy from folks who are racist. To say that, I would never say that everybody in the Tea Party is racist. I haven't talked to everybody in the Tea Party,
right.
But I think that it does have a large sort of backbone of support among people who are racist, and I'm sure there are members of the Tea Party who are not racist as well.
Now there was a young lady that you interviewed for the book, and you posed that question to her in terms of why the Tea Party does not just denounce any elements of racism within its ranks. And what was her response?
Well, her basic response, which again was not terribly coherent, was that the Tea Party really didn't have anything to do with race, and it was all about economics and whatnot. And her second response, in essence, was that the Tea Party was not one person or even one entity. So it would be difficult for the Tea Party, which she calls a grassroots movement, to collectively denounce anything because it's just not organized that way. But I think if one is being honest about what they're about, if you have a large base of support, many of whom are racist, and you're interested in keeping that base of support, and then you're not inclined to denounce them. And I think the answer why the Tea Party leaders don't denounce a lot of these organizations is just that simple.
We're going to take a phone call real quick. We have Tommy. Tommy, you are on the Ink Spot. Your question or comment?
Hey, guys, you know, from the very inception of your program, man, I am so enlightened each Sunday after church of the topics that you come on and with the just wonderful guests like you have on today. So I congratulate you guys for this program.
Thank you.
But one, I would just like to simply say I don't see how on earth that a white person could ever fear that a black person is going to do to them what they did to us, seeing how, first of all, for us to do that, we would have to go and snatch them off of some country and then throw them in the bottom of boats and then take away all of their humanistic rights. So, I mean, that is ludicrous in itself. And two, I cannot see how white people can be mad about things, and they want things not to change from the way it used to be when it was white folks that did it to themselves. No black person is the cause of what's happened in this country. No, I think it's the same old complex that, you know, as soon as things don't go right with you, you look for the weakest link. And so since the weakest link seems to be us, well, let's just pound the hell out of their communities and let's just continue this nonsense when you have a country that's supposed to be about the people and you got a Senate and Congress that's absolutely doing nothing. I don't see how any Tea Party member can ever even open their mouths. What bill have they put on the table to help anybody? And with that, I'll continue to listen and get great comments from your guests. And man, I listen to you every Sunday. God bless your program.
Okay, thank you for your comments, Tommy. Ellis, what about that? Do you think that Tea Party?
Well, I think he makes a very good point. I mean, blacks aren't in any position to enslave folks from Europe. But as I said before, I don't think the Tea Party is that coherent. I don't think they have the sense that black folks are going to throw them into slavery. I think it's a much more emotional, much less well reasoned sort of response to a world that they just are feeling less and less comfortable in. And I think part of them feeling less and less comfortable in is that they think they are losing some of their racial advantage and just don't like it. But your caller's absolutely right. I mean, we as collectively as African Americans aren't in any position to do to white Americans or Europeans what was done to our ancestors.
I remember reading a quote by Malcolm X, and he made the comment that black people, that he wanted black people to be as angry as they ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you believe that black people ought to be angry?
Well, I think that there are two functions that that anger can serve. I think it's useful to have outrage over social inequity. It's useful to have indignation over things that are wrong, because that motivates you to change them. There's another kind of anger, which is self-defeating, and which basically turns into a sense of, the world is against me. I can't do anything. I can't accomplish anything because the deck is so stacked against me. I can't move. I think if one, indulges in that kind of anger, it can just be self-defeating. I think there is a long history in our communities and in others of having what you can call righteous indignation over things, and I think we're seeing that to some extent with this so-called Wall Street movement now. So sure.
Okay, thank you for joining us. We appreciate you spending some time with us on the Ink Spot.
I appreciate it, Stanley. You take care.